Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 27th, 2023 Monday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Mayor wants to keep workers downtown amid big overhaul, written by Joe Rubino of the Denver Post. Third group of hostages released by Wafa Sharafa and Sammy Magdi of the Associated Press. GOP tries to pair aid, security at border by Mary Claire Jelinek and Stephen Groves of the AP. U.S. troops will train on weapons with known risks by Dave Phillips of the New York Times, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Mayor wants to keep workers downtown amid big overhaul. Updated plans for $133.5 million project focus on Johnston's revitalization goals by Joe Rubino of the Denver Post. The Wellington E. Webb Municipal Office Building is the workhorse of Denver's real estate portfolio, providing space for 2,100 employees across departments from the clerk and recorder's office to city planning to parks and recreation. Now more than 20 years after it was built at 201 West Colfax Avenue, work is underway on a $133.5 million overhaul. The renovation will touch all 12 floors of the gray, oval-shaped office tower north of Civic Center Park over the next 2 years. And even while it's under construction, the Webb Building is playing a part in new Mayor Mike Johnston's economic plans for downtown Denver. Displaced employees won't be working from home while their typical office spaces are being painted, carpeted, and refurnished with new equipment and gear. They will simply shift a block or two away. Thanks to some carefully planned phasing and a $4.9 million lease for space in nearby Republic Plaza, city workers will remain on hybrid work schedules that keep them coming downtown at least 3 days per week, according to Lisa Lumley, the city director of real estate. By all accounts, we anticipated everybody could work from home, Lumley told city council members last month about the city's initial plans for disruptions in the Webb Building. When Mayor Johnston took office, he had asked us to reevaluate this from an economic development revitalization standpoint downtown, to reconsider and go back out and find very inexpensive space. The Webb renovation is designed to set the building up to be a functional hub of local government into the future. Officials project that the city will need seats for 600 or more office workers downtown by 2027, and that is not possible in a building occupied by bulky office furniture that's well spread out under the original floor layouts. Some of it is so old that the manufacturers are no longer making replacement parts. The project will improve capacity, catch up on decades worth of maintenance needs, and improve accessibility to meet Department of Justice standards for public buildings. That means lowering drinking fountains and kitchen counter heights, adjusting bathroom stall sizes, and more, according to city spokeswoman Laura Schwartz. The building was named after the still-living former mayor who left office in 2003, just after the building opened in late 2002. It cost $132.4 million to build, which is nearly $230 million in inflation-adjusted dollars. As city officials looked for outside office space to accommodate the rotating moves into and out of the Webb Building, they opted to piggyback on another recent city deal for space in the 56-story Republic Plaza, Denver's tallest building. The agreement, approved by the council in October, added 72,000 square feet of furnished office space to a $49.9 million lease inked there in June to house the Denver District Attorney's Office through 2036. The DA's relocation also will free up future space in the Webb Building. Before the council's recent 9-4 vote on the added space, Lumley explained to some skeptical members that the decision to lease more space at Republic Plaza was, in part, about ensuring smooth operations for city teams. They include portions of the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure that officials found did not thrive in a work-from-home environment, she said. But the extra space became even more urgent after Johnston took office. During the spring mayoral campaign, he made downtown revitalization a priority of a successful campaign, arguing that keeping city workers circulating through the area and spending money on lunches or shopping supports that goal. And keeping city workers downtown most days. Johnston pledged $58 million in spending toward that revitalization goal in his first budget as mayor. In a letter accompanying his initial budget proposal in September, the mayor highlighted the importance of office real estate to downtown success. "Our downtown faces among the highest commercial vacancy rates of any city in the nation," he wrote. "Reversing this trend will require a coordinated effort to revitalize not only the Central Business District, but create a central neighborhood district where people of all income levels gather year-round." Republic Plaza is an example of the office market strain. It made headlines earlier this year when its ownership group reportedly was struggling to make payments on a loan that could have landed the building in foreclosure. But Lumley assured council members that the issue had been resolved and didn't pose a threat to the city's plans, since the building's owners were never in default while they restructured their loan. That lease isn't the city's first move into nearby private office space in recent years. It also has subleased space from the Denver Post's ownership group in 101 West Colfax Avenue. The downtown building facing Civic Center still bears the Post's name, but is no longer home to the newspaper's offices. That arrangement dates back to 2016, when the city secured two floors to make room for its ballooning employee headcount. The city has since grown its footprint and amended its deal there at least six times, most recently in September. The city's cumulative sublease total in the Post building, including rolling expiration dates through 2029, is now just shy of $44 million. Some downtown stakeholders celebrated the decision to maintain city workers' presence in the Central Business District, the eastern segment of downtown that was struggling with a lack of activity even before the pandemic sent many office workers home in 2020 for an extended period. "We are really grateful for Mayor Johnston having the vision to not only improve the Webb building so city employees can be downtown in the long term, but to keep them downtown in the interim," said Britt Deal, a spokeswoman for the Downtown Denver Partnership. Government workers, city, state, and federal, are the second largest segment of workers in downtown Denver, Deal said, with a combined 25,000 stationed in the area. "Even on hybrid schedules, when thousands of them may stay home on a given day, that presence makes a difference in the city where the partnership is tracking a 30% office vacancy rate. It's most concentrated in the blocks near the Webb building." City employees can be ambassadors for downtown. Councilman Chris Hines, now in his second term, saw the boundaries of his centrally located Council District 10 expand this year to include more of downtown. He knows how tight space is in the historic city and county building where he keeps his office. "That makes the Webb building, which doesn't have the limitations of its historic neighbor, critical to keeping up with the needs of city business and residents." Maintaining a municipal employee presence downtown during construction shows the city is leading by example, he said. City employees can be ambassadors for those who haven't visited downtown in a couple of years, who maybe had a bad experience during their last visit, Hines said. "Downtown is a better place than it was even 2 years ago. And in the next year, once we start opening up blocks of the under-construction 16th Street Mall, we're going to find that people really enjoy the new downtown experience." The city is financing the Webb building's renovations using $300 million worth of certificates of participation, a form of borrowing that pledges city assets and, unlike municipal bonds, is not subject to voter approval. That amount also covers plans to refinance some old city debt that remains from when the building was first built, officials said this summer. When it's all said and done, city officials expect the Webb project to allow them to move all of the roughly 600 employees currently working in the Post building back to city-owned space. But that doesn't mean Denver won't remain a real estate player downtown outside of the Webb building's curved walls. According to Lumley, the city is considering a potential purchase at some point of the Post building. It's not owned by the newspaper or its ownership group, but they hold a long-term lease of several floors, which they have subleased to other tenants, including the city. We're keeping all options on the table to meet the city's space needs, Lumley wrote in an email when asked about the city's future plans in the Post building. As we free up space, thereby bringing city agencies back into the Webb Municipal Building in the coming years, we are also considering the future best use of this downtown office building for other public services. Third group of hostages released. Israeli-American citizen 4 is freed. U.S. Hamas hope troop is extended, by Wafa Sharafa and Sami Magdi of the Associated Press. The fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas was back on track Sunday as Hamas freed 17 more hostages, including 14 Israelis and the first American, in a third exchange under a four-day truce that the U.S. said it would hope would be extended. In turn, Israel released 39 Palestinian prisoners. Most hostages were handed over directly to Israel, waving to a cheering crowd as they arrived at an Air Force base. Others left through Egypt. Israel's army said one was airlifted to a hospital, and the director of Soroka Medical Center said Elma Avraham, 84, was in life-threatening condition as a result of an extended period of time when an elderly woman was not taken care of as needed. The youngest hostage released was Abigail Edan, a 4-year-old girl and dual Israeli-American citizen whose parents were killed in the Hamas attack that started the war on October 7th. What she endured was unthinkable, President Joe Biden said of the first American freed under the truce. He did not know her condition and did not provide updates on other American hostages. Biden said his goal was to extend the ceasefire deal as long as possible. In all, 9 children, ages 17 and younger, were on the list, according to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office. 3 more Thai nationals were released. Separately, Hamas said it released a Russian hostage in response to the efforts of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Hamas has been designated as a terrorist organization by the United States, Canada, and the European Union. The Palestinian prisoners released were children and young men ages 15 to 19, largely accused of public disorder, property damage, and in some cases causing or threatening physical harm to Israeli officers by throwing stones and Molotov cocktails. Many were scooped up from protests and confrontations with troops. In turn, many Palestinians view prisoner held by Israel, including those implicated in attacks, as heroes resisting occupation. A fourth exchange is expected on Monday, the last day of the ceasefire, during which a total of 50 hostages and 150 Palestinian prisoners are to be freed. Most are women and minors. International mediators, led by the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar, are trying to extend the ceasefire that started Friday. "We can get all hostages back home. We have to keep pushing," said 2 of Eden's relatives, a great aunt and cousin, in a statement thanking mediators. Hamas, for the first time, said it would seek to extend the deal by looking to release a large number of hostages. Netanyahu issued a statement saying he had spoken to Biden and reiterated his offer to extend the ceasefire by an additional day for every 10 hostages Hamas releases. But he said Israel would resume its offensive with all of our might once the truce expires. Ahead of the latest hostage release, Netanyahu donned body armor and visited the Gaza Strip, where he spoke with troops. "At the end of the day, we will return everyone," he said of the hostages, adding that "we are continuing until the end, until victory. Nothing will stop us." It was not clear where he went inside Gaza. This is the first significant pause in 7 weeks of war, marked by the deadliest Israeli-Palestinian violence in decades. More than 13,300 Palestinians have been killed, roughly two-thirds of them women and minors, according to the health ministry in Hamas-ruled Gaza. The war has claimed more than 1,200 Israelis, mostly civilians, killed in the initial attack. In New York, hundreds of Jewish protesters and allies demanding a permanent ceasefire in Gaza shut down vehicle traffic on the Manhattan Bridge in both directions for several hours Sunday. A New York police spokesperson said one person was arrested for reckless endangerment and two others were issued summonses for disorderly conduct. The pause has given some respite to Gaza's 2.3 million people still reeling from relentless Israeli bombardment that has driven three-quarters of the population from their homes and leveled residential areas. Rocket fire from Hamas into Israel also went silent. War-weary Palestinians in northern Gaza, where the offensive has focused, made their way through entire city blocks gutted by airstrikes. But those among the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who fled the north have been turned back by Israeli troops while trying to return to check their homes. They opened fire on anyone approaching from the south, said Rami Hazaran, who fled Gaza City. The Israeli military has ordered Palestinians not to return to the north or approach the border fence. The Palestinian Red Crescent Rescue Service and Israeli forces opened fire Sunday on two farmers in central Gaza, killing one and wounding the other. An Israeli military spokesperson said they weren't aware of the episode. The United Nations says the truce made it possible to scale up the delivery of food, water, and medicine to the largest volume since the start of the war, but it calls the 160 to 200 trucks a day hardly enough. It was able to deliver fuel for the first time since the war began and to reach areas in the north for the first time in a month. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society said 50 Egyptian aid trucks crossed through Israeli checkpoints to reach Gaza City and northern areas Sunday. Hamas announced the death of Ahmed al-Gandour, who was in charge of northern Gaza and a member of its top military council. He is the highest-ranking member of Hamas known to have been killed in the fighting. Israel's military confirmed the death. Al-Gandour had survived at least three Israeli attempts on his life and was involved in a cross-border attack in 2006 in which Palestinians captured an Israeli soldier, according to the Counter-Extremism Project, an advocacy group based in Washington. Hamas said he was killed along with three other senior officials, including Ayman Sayem, who Israel says was in charge of Hamas's rocket-firing unit. The Israeli military mentioned both men in a November 16th statement, saying it had targeted an underground complex where Hamas leaders were hiding. Elsewhere, Palestinian health authorities said Sunday that five Palestinians were killed in an Israeli military raid in the West Bank city of Jenin that began the day before. The war toll in the West Bank is now 239. GOP tries to pair aid security at border by Mary Claire Jelinek and Stephen Groves of the Associated Press. As Congress returns this week, lawmakers will be trying to forge an agreement on sending a new round of wartime assistance to Ukraine. But to succeed, they will have to find agreement on an issue that has confounded them for decades. Republicans in both chambers of Congress have made clear that they will not support additional aid for Ukraine unless it is paired with border security measures to help manage the influx of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. Their demand has injected one of the most contentious issues in American politics into a foreign policy debate that was already difficult. Time is short for a deal. A small bipartisan group in the Senate is taking the lead and working to find a narrow compromise that can overcome a likely filibuster by winning 60 votes. But even if they can reach a modest agreement, there is no guarantee it would pass the House, where Republicans are insisting on wholesale changes to U.S. border and immigration policies. Republicans hope that Democrats will feel political pressure to accept some of their border proposals after illegal crossings topped a daily average of more than 8,000 earlier this fall. President Joe Biden, who is running for re-election next year, has faced pressure even from fellow Democrats over the migrant flow. Finding compromise will be exceedingly difficult. As they left for Thanksgiving break, Senate negotiators said they were still far apart. A look at some of the issues under discussion and why they have proved so difficult to resolve. Asylum and humanitarian parole. Changing the asylum system for migrants is a top priority for Republicans. They want to make it more difficult for asylum seekers to prove in initial interviews that they have a credible fear of political, religious, or racial persecution in their home country before advancing toward asylum in the United States. Republicans in the House have passed legislation that would detain families at the border, require migrants to make the asylum claim at an official port of entry, and either detain them or require them to remain outside the U.S. while their case is processed. U.S. and international law give migrants the right to seek safety from persecution, but the number of people applying for asylum in the U.S. has reached historic highs. Critics say many people take advantage of the system to live and work in the U.S. while they wait for their asylum claims to be processed in court. Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, an independent who is part of the Senate negotiations, said in an Arizona radio interview that one of the lawmakers' goals is to ensure that those who are here seeking asylum have an actual claim to asylum. Compromise is far from certain. Many Democrats are wary of making it harder to flee persecution, and the details of each policy shift are contentious. Hardline conservatives in the House, already unlikely to support further Ukraine aid, have also signaled they won't accept policy changes that deviate much from a bill passed in May that would have remade the U.S. immigration system. Their stance means at least some support for House Democrats will be needed to pass any agreement. No easy task. Some progressives have already said they will oppose any Republican-led changes to immigration policy. The cruel, inhumane, and unworkable solutions offered by Republicans will only create more disorder and confusion at the border, said Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Infrastructure and enforcement. Lawmakers may find it easier to reach consensus on other areas of border policy, particularly when it comes to border staffing and enforcement. Negotiators have looked at steps that could be taken to reinforce existing infrastructure at the border, including hiring and boosting pay for Border Patrol officers and improving technology. One proposal advanced by a bipartisan group of senators would call for hiring of more Border Patrol agents, raising their pay, and ensuring they receive overtime. Biden has shown a willingness to accept tougher enforcement measures, recently resuming deportation of migrants to Venezuela and waiving federal laws to allow for the construction of border wall that began under then-President Donald Trump. The White House also wants to install new imaging technology at ports of entry that would allow authorities to quickly scan vehicles for illegal imports, including fentanyl. Republicans say that is not enough. They want more robust improvements, including more expansive construction of a border wall. What Biden seeks. Biden's emergency request to Congress included aid for Ukraine, Israel, and other U.S. allies, along with $14 billion to bolster the immigration system and border security. Money would go toward hiring more Border Patrol agents, immigration judges, and asylum officers. It's part of Biden's strategy of trying to simultaneously turn away from Trump's hardline policies, but adapt to the realities of crossings at the border. Still, polls indicate widespread frustration with Biden's handling of immigration and the border, creating a political vulnerability as he seeks re-election. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas told the Senate Appropriations Committee this month that the administration has been faced with a global phenomenon of displaced people migrating in numbers that have not been seen since World War II. It is unanimous that our broken immigration system is in dire need of reform, Mayorkas said. Democrats have other immigration priorities, such as expanding legal immigration pathways or work authorizations for migrants already in the U.S. Democrats have also warned that the danger of delaying aid to Ukraine as it enters another winter of war against Russia. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, the second-ranking Democrat in the Senate, said it's a mistake to create a situation where we have to do significant immigration reform in the next few weeks, or we won't send money to assist the people in Ukraine or other causes important to our national security. Republicans have been adamant about the need to address Ukraine and the border at the same time. Representative Mike Turner, a strong supporter of aid to Ukraine and chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, told NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday that he thought passing Biden's package would be very difficult to accomplish by year's end. The impediment currently is the White House policy on the southern border, said Turner, Republican Ohio. What's likely not on the table? Lawmakers seem like unlikely to address one of the nation's longstanding immigration issues, granting some form of permanent legal status to thousands of immigrants who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children. Republicans have made clear that will not be addressed in this package, which they want to be more narrowly focused on border security measures. As Congress struggled to pass a comprehensive immigration overhaul, President Barack Obama launched the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program in 2012 to shield those immigrants from deportation and allow them to work legally in the country. But it has been caught up in the courts ever since. And Trump, the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024, tried to end it when he was in the White House. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, one of the Senate negotiators, would not say last week whether his side had proposed DACA provisions as part of the talks, but he said any deal has to respect both Republican and Democratic priorities. The more Republicans want, the more Democrats are going to want, Murphy said. Republicans argue that Ukraine aid could be a tough sell to some of their voters, and the border policy is the compromise. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, a Republican who has been involved in the talks, said before the Thanksgiving holiday that the negotiations were not very close yet because Democrats have not yet accepted that the negotiations are not border security for Democratic immigration priorities. It's border security for Ukraine aid. So far, leaders in both parties have encouraged the talks. But as senators restart their work and face pressure to approve funding by the end of the year, some are warning that a narrow deal is likely the best that they can do. I don't think it's realistic to solve anywhere close to the whole problem in the next 2 weeks, Murphy said. U.S. troops still train on weapons with known risk, by Dave Phillips of the New York Times. A blast shattered the stillness of a meadow in the Ozark Mountains on an autumn afternoon, then another and another and another until the whole meadow was in flames. Special operations troops were training with rocket launchers again. Each operator held a launch tube on his shoulder a few inches from his head, then took aim and sent a rocket flying at 500 miles per hour. And each launch sent a shock wave whipping through every cell in the operator's brain. For generations, the military assumed that this kind of blast exposure was safe, even as evidence mounted that repetitive blasts may do serious and lasting harm. In recent years, Congress, pressed by veterans who were exposed to these shock waves, has ordered the military to set safety limits and start tracking troops' exposure. In response, the Pentagon created a sprawling Warfighter Brain Health Initiative to study the issue, gather data, and propose corrective strategies. And last year, for the first time, it set a threshold above which a weapon blast is considered hazardous. Despite the order, though, things have hardly changed on the ground. Training continues largely as it did before. Troops say they see little being done to limit or track blast exposure, and weapons like shoulder-fired rockets that are known to deliver a shockwave well above the safety threshold are still in wide use. The disconnect fits a pattern that has repeated for more than a decade. Top leaders talk of the importance of protecting troops' brains, but the military fails to take practical steps to ensure safety. It's extremely frustrating, said Paul Scher, a former Army Ranger and a policy expert at the Center for a New American Security, who published a report in 2018, funded by the Defense Department, about the dangers of repeated blasts from firing weapons. We've known for years that these weapons are dangerous. There are simple things we can do to protect people, and we're not doing them. Nowhere is that disconnect more clear than on the firing range at the Military Training Center in the Ozarks, Fort Chaffee in Arkansas. With flames still leaping from the meadow, A few of the special operations troops walked to a pair of air-conditioned trailers just behind the firing line, where a research team drew blood samples, strapped sensors to their heads, and ran tests, searching for evidence of brain injuries. Measurements taken by the team from scores of troops over 3 years showed that in the days after firing rockets, they had worse memories and reaction times, worse coordination, lower cognitive and executive function, and elevated levels of proteins in their blood that are markers of brain injury. Sensors placed on the operators' helmets and body armor show that the rocket launcher they were firing, the Carl Gustav M3, delivers a blast that is often twice the recommended safety threshold. But when the research team finished running tests, the operators walked right back out and started firing again. Dr. Michael Roy, the lead researcher, said he designed the 5-year study to deliver the kind of empirical data that could help the military make better decisions. The question is, does this affect performance, he said. We are seeing it does. He added, if you are on a mission and you can't remember things and your balance is off, that could be a real problem. Research by his team and others suggests that troops appear to recover after a few days or weeks, just as people recover from concussions. But, as with concussions, there is growing concern that repeated exposure may lead to permanent brain damage and serious long-term consequences for mental health. A 2021 Navy study for the records of 138,000 service members found that those in career fields with more blast exposure had an increased risk of developing anxiety disorders, depression, migraines, substance abuse problems, dementia, and a number of psychiatric disorders, including schizophrenia. Meanwhile, an investigation by the New York Times found that many soldiers and Marines who were exposed to blast waves from firing heavy artillery in Syria and Iraq came home with life-shattering mental and physical problems. Special Operations Command said in response to questions from the Times that it plans to keep using the Carl Gustav rocket launcher, but sparingly, because of its potential negative effects. But the command has taken steps to reduce blast exposure for instructors and assistant gunners, it said, and now requires them to stand farther away when a gunner fires. During the recent training observed by the Times, none of those safety steps could be seen. It's really negligent, given everything the Pentagon knows that they haven't taken action, said David Burkholder, a professor of engineering at Rochester Institute of Technology in New York. In 2010, at the request of the military, Burkholder and a team from the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency developed a small, wearable gauge to measure blast exposure. The agency fielded the blast gauge on about 10,000 troops sent to Afghanistan in 2011, intending to measure blast exposure from roadside bombs. But researchers analyzing the data instead found that 75% of the troops' exposure was coming from their own weapons. It was hugely, hugely surprising, Burkholder said. The danger was us. We were doing it to ourselves. Rather than expand the blast gauge program, though, the Army quietly shelved it in 2016. The Army said at the time that it did so because the gauges did not provide consistent and reliable data. Burkholder, who found a company that makes blast gauges but left in 2021 and now has no financial stake, said he thought the gauges were shelved because the data told leaders something they didn't want to hear. For 2 years, he pressed the Army Surgeon General and members of Congress to revive the program. Without real-time monitoring, he argued, the military was blind to the risks. He said he made no progress. Merely issuing the gauges to service members might reduce exposure significantly, several researchers said. Time and again in recent studies that equipped troops with gauges and let them see their exposure, the troops have changed their behavior on their own to avoid blasts. The enlisted folks are smart, Burkholder said. Give them the tools, often they can solve the problem. That has yet to happen. Though a congressional mandate passed in 2018 requires monitoring of blast exposure, the Pentagon is still studying how to go about it. Special Operations Command said in 2019 that it would start using gauges to all its operators, but 4 years later, only those taking part in research studies had them. Special Operations Command told the Times that its blast gauge program was in the final development stage. Man dies after he was twice medically cleared at hospital. He was taken to the hospital a second time over possible overdose, deputies say. By Jacob Factor of the Denver Post, a man died Saturday at the Larimer County Jail after he was medically cleared at a hospital twice the day before he died, according to the Larimer County Sheriff's Office. Johnstown police arrested the man Friday morning at about 9:40 a.m. on felony drug charges, deputies said in a news release. They took him to a hospital where he was medically cleared for incarceration and officers took him to the jail. During the booking process, according to the news release, he began to show signs of a possible overdose and was taken back to the hospital. The hospital medically discharged him just after 9 p.m. Friday and police booked him into jail, according to the news release. At about 1:30 p.m. Saturday afternoon, a deputy conducting routine status checks found the man unresponsive in his cell. Medical staff and deputies began performing life-saving measures, but the man died. He was the only person in his cell, according to the news release. The Larimer County Coroner's Office will determine the cause and manner of death, and the Loveland Police Department will lead the 8th Judicial Critical Incident Response Team's investigation. In brief, the Denver Police Department is investigating the deaths of four people found outdoors in just more than 24 hours during the snowy, chilly weekend. All four deaths remain under investigation, but a police spokesperson told the Denver Post on Sunday morning that investigators didn't believe either of Saturday's two deaths were related to the cold snap. No further information was available on the third and fourth deaths reported Sunday morning and evening, police said. None of the cases are homicide investigations, though police said they would update the public if that changes. The Denver Office of the Medical Examiner will release the victims' names and causes of death after further investigation. An arson suspect was hospitalized Saturday after a medical incident that occurred while deputies from the Adams County Sheriff's Office arrested him. Just after 2:30 p.m. on Saturday, deputies responded to reports of an arson in progress in the 6800 block of Colorado 79 in Bennett, according to a Sunday news release from the Adams County Sheriff's Office. When deputies arrived on scene and contacted the male suspect, he became combative, according to the news release. The man fought with deputies, and when they tried to take him into custody, he stopped breathing, the news release stated. Deputies provided medical aid to man on scene, and he was transported to a local hospital for medical treatment. His condition was unknown Sunday. According to the Sheriff's Office, the 17th Judicial District Critical Incident Response Team is investigating the incident, submitted by Lauren Pennington of the Denver Post. In sports, on a roll, defense gets more takeaways to claim fifth straight victory, move to 6-5. Broncos outgame Browns on ground, 169-107, score two rushing touchdowns by Parker Gabriel of the Denver Post. Denver grows more cosmopolitan by the year, but what the Broncos have cooking up isn't likely to earn any attention from the fancy folk at Michelin. On the menu these days at Casa Sean Payton, meat, potatoes, and a fresh-baked pile of turnovers every weekend. Slowly but surely, Payton and the Broncos' offense have learned to eat their vegetables. Vance Joseph's defense will stick to your ribs or, more often than not, plow right through them. The whole refrigerator of ingredients nearly spoiled in the September heat. They're not exactly the most stocked pantry in the NFL, and it took a long time for the kitchen to find its rhythm. But at the tail end of Thanksgiving weekend, this team put together its most satisfying meal yet. A big, bad, rugged 29-12 victory over Cleveland. The ingredient list? The Broncos outgained the Browns on the ground, 169-107. They held the Cleveland offense to 2 of 13 on third down and converted 6 of 14 themselves. They took the ball away 3 more times, that's 15 in the past 4 games now, and finished plus 2 in the turnover department. They staved off a second-half push from the Browns and a rash of penalties and authored put-away series on both sides of the ball. They bullied a team that made a habit of doing the bullying for the first 11 weeks of the season. Yes, the Broncos have finally fine-tuned their recipe. It ain't pretty, but the cooks couldn't care less. This is the way. There were a lot of things we did today that I was pleased with, Peyton, the Broncos head coach said. We felt like we beat a good football team. Peyton's not one to lavish praise, but after the Broncos put away a fifth straight win, moved to 6-5 on the season, the first time the club's been above 500 since week 3 last year, and put themselves squarely in playoff contention, he hit on a point that clearly came with pride. You could hear that game, Peyton said of the physicality. That was something from the sideline. You could hear that game. His team made the majority of the noise from the start. Over two pulverizing 80-yard touchdown drives early in the game, they ran the ball 16 times in 22 plays. On the day, they churned out 169 rushing yards on 39 attempts, a 4.3 per carry average suppressed by late game clock milking, and finally found the kind of creativity and variety to keep a talented Browns defense off balance. Javonte Williams ground out 65 on 18 attempts. Samaje Perine ripped his way to 55 on just 7 attempts. Russell Wilson sprinkled in zone red work beautifully, at one point baiting in all-world defensive end Myles Garrett and darting 19 yards around him to set up his own touchdown run. It was one of the areas on tape that you saw some other teams have success with, Peyton said. Not necessarily always RPOs. They may have been runs that you're reading the end, weak reads, zone reads. That was something we thought we would be effective, and we were able to have some big plays coming out of it. Wilson scored with his legs for the first time this season. He finished with just 134 passing yards, the seventh time in 11 outings this fall he's failed to top 200. The Broncos haven't gone for more than 339 offensive yards over their winning streak, and they've averaged 293.6. That's not exactly cooking, but it works. We knew coming into this game that it was going to be what we call a bad game, a more physical game, tight end, Chris Manhurt said. That was a point of emphasis, and I'm glad everybody came out and executed on that. Even still, when the offense came out with a by now predictable stinker of a possession to start the third quarter, the Browns took the ball and went 79 yards over 13 plays to score a touchdown and get within 14-12. At that point, they had mounted consecutive scoring drives of 57, 67, and 79 yards. Then Vance Joseph's group grabbed the fire extinguisher. Over the Browns' final five possessions, they moved the ball 48 yards total in 22 plays, 20 coming via penalty. Two plays after rookie quarterback Dorian Thompson-Robinson was knocked out of the game by a vicious Baron Browning hit, DJ Jones recovered a fumble on a botched trick play. In a day and age where you see a lot of passing, this cute screen game and stuff like that, to play a team that plays like that, it's definitely a team you're excited to play against, defensive lineman Zach Allen said. Give them credit. They've got some really good players, great offensive line, physical. Luckily, we got the win today. There wasn't really much luck about it. Cleveland's final four drives finished like this. Punt, fumble, turnover on downs, safety. From a tight game to a convincing final margin on the strength of the Broncos' fully revived defense. Once you get one, they come in bunches. That's kind of the way football works, said Allen, who sacked P.J. Walker for the safety at the end. From sacks, picks, turnovers, wins, touchdowns, the whole thing. They come in bunches. We're on a hot streak now, and we're learning to win games. We're finishing games. We're in a good spot. Indeed. Broncos are 6-5. They're tied with Indianapolis and next week's opponent Houston for the final playoff spot in the AFC and trailing the Colts on tiebreakers. Playing beyond week 18 is no longer a pie way out of there in the sky. It's baking in the oven. It has that undeniable scent. But in order to enjoy that part of the menu, they've got to start a set of three straight on the road by winning at least one of the next two against the Texans and Los Angeles Chargers. Maybe both. We've got games to win now, Singleton said. It's not just our room believing in us anymore. It's time to go. Russ, VJ have gone from zeros to heroes during streak, by Mark Kisla of the Denver Post. Hey, Broncos country, now that your favorite NFL team has won 5 games in a row, are you ready to issue an apology to Russell Wilson and Vance Joseph? Let me make it easy for you. I will go first. When this football team was 1-5, I was ready to run Wilson and Joseph out of this dusty old cow town. My reasons were strong, but I was wrong. After giving Cleveland a 29-12 beatdown in their most complete performance of this NFL season, the Broncos have established a winning identity that can carry them all the way to the playoffs. The quarterback and defensive coordinator who many, me included, wanted to run out of Denver are now leading an improbable run to the playoffs. During a turnaround nobody saw coming, Wilson and Joseph have gone from zeros to heroes. "I've never doubted," Wilson said Sunday. "I've never doubted our football team and where we could go." That identity has been established by the two people who not long ago were designated persona non grata, number one and number 1A in Broncos country. Joseph has reshaped a defense that was the hapless victim of 70 points in Miami by establishing a persona as nasty as pro wrestling villain Ric Flair. Hit hard, flex, and let the penalty flags fall where they may. With evangelical belief not seen around here since the height of Tebow mania, Wilson has rescued a lost season by becoming such a throwback of an option quarterback that I might have to give serious consideration to putting him on my Heisman Trophy ballot. "The best thing about us is it's about us," Wilson said. "It's about us being together." That might sound corny, but it doesn't make it any less true. When the team could have folded, Wilson held it together. During this 5-game winning streak, the Broncos are playing bully ball that's more 1970s than disco. Wilson is averaging a meager 179 yards passing per game, but there's no arguing against a touchdown to interception ratio of 8-0. It's not Wilson's fault that general manager George Patton was dumb enough to give him a $245 million contract extension before he won a single game for Denver. Wilson is now an old gunslinger who has learned how to live another day, or at least until the fourth quarter, when there's still enough magic in his bag to pull out a victory. "We're pretty damn confident in our abilities," said tight end Adam Trautman, whose sliding touchdown catch in the end zone after a vintage Wilson scramble staked Denver to a 24-12 lead early in the fourth quarter. "While the Broncos would be wise to draft a quarterback in 2024, I also now expect Wilson to be back in a Denver uniform next season because he and Coach Sean Payton have found a way to not only peacefully coexist, but embrace the beauty of winning, gritty, not pretty." Since surrendering 10 touchdowns to the Dolphins, Joseph has given the defense an extreme makeover. Denver moved on from the mistakes that were Randy Gregory and Frank Clark as edge rushers, with Jonathan Cooper stepping up and Baron Browning getting healthy. "Our defense has been lights out, one of the best defenses in the world. Those guys have been unbelievable," Wilson said. "Vance Joseph has done a great job with those guys, getting those guys ready every week. Jaquan McMillan has been a revelation, not to mention the feistiest slot corner this team hasn't been seen since the prime of Chris Harris. Fabian Moreau has patched a huge hole at cornerback, while P.J. Locke proves the Broncos are better at safety in the absence of Kareem Jackson. While members of the secondary wore free K-Jack t-shirts during warm-ups, the fact of the matter is Denver is 3-0 in the games he has missed due to suspension for dirty hits. Rather than whine about being penalized for hitting too hard, the Broncos should embrace their bad boy image. As everyone from Ronnie Lott to Ray Lewis can attest, in the NFL, it is often better to be feared than to be loved. "I am really proud of this team and how we have fought to keep it rolling," said Justin Simmons, whose early season injury hurt worse than anyone could have imagined. How far can these Broncos go? Well, they play their final regular season game at Las Vegas in another 40 days and 40 nights. At fewer than 40 nights later, there's another little football game scheduled in Vegas on the second Sunday in February. Although I did predict a 10-7 record for the Broncos prior to the season, I can't say I saw this wild and crazy path to the playoffs unfolding. Super Bowl? Yes, it sounds preposterous to me. But who are we to doubt Wilson and Joseph? Shiffrin extends her record with 90th career victory by Robert F. Kubady of the AP. Michaela Shiffrin has extended her record of World Cup wins to 90, and she has done so in style. The American two-time Olympic champion dominated a slalom Sunday, pleasing the home crowd by posting the fastest time in both runs on the superstar course and beating her Slovakian rival Petra Vlova by 33/100 of a second. "It's amazing to do this, especially here with the home crowd," said Shiffrin, who is from Colorado but can almost consider Killington a hometown race because she honed her skills nearby at the Burke Mountain Academy as a teenager. "It's just such a good vibe, and there's a little extra intensity because we want this to be good for you guys to watch. I hope it was a good show," she said in a course side interview. Shiffrin was put to the test by a frenetic second run from Vlohova, the Olympic champion who led the race by more than a second with only the American left in the start gate. Shiffrin lost half of her first run lead of 28/100 at the first split, but she gradually gained time on Vlohova again. After crossing the finish, Shiffrin briefly bent forward before getting up and showing the crowd a few fist pumps. It feels really good. It's amazing to race in front of this crowd no matter what. Being in a position to win is something different. That's really spectacular," she said. Shiffrin collected her 90 wins from 254 starts on the World Cup since her 2011 debut on the circuit 2 days before her 16th birthday. She won her first race at a slalom in Sweden in December 2012 and set the record for most World Cup wins across genders when passing Swedish great Ingemar Stenmark's mark of 86 in a race at the same resort last March. Sunday's result marked her 55th win in slalom. No other skier, male or female, has ever won more than 46 races in a single discipline. Vlohova had won the first slalom of the season in Finland 2 weeks ago and held a clear lead over Shiffrin in the second race the next day, but then she straddled a gate and handed victory to the American. On Sunday, however, Vlohova made Shiffrin work hard for the win. "I'm satisfied with my second run," Vlohova said, "but first run I didn't go well. I lost in the first run, but the second run was a good show. Michaela, she was stronger than me." Shiffrin has won 6 of the 7 slaloms at the annual World Cup weekend on the East Coast, with her streak interrupted last year when she led after the first run but finished 5th. Before her second run Sunday, Shiffrin recalled what happened last year. "These kind of moments, you can call it a disappointment. Those are the things that stick with me more than winning actually does. So I always feel more doubt in myself than confidence because of races like here last year. That's something that really fuels me," she said. Wendy Holdener finished 3rd, trailing Shiffrin by 1.37 seconds. Lena Dürr of Germany dropped from 2nd to 4th. Jokic Nuggets bounce back in Wemby's first visit to Denver by Bennett Durando of the Denver Post. Not even the terrifyingly territorial wingspan of Victor Wembanyama can enter the house of Jokic and prevail. When the Nuggets need a win, and they needed one badly Sunday, Ball Arena is their old, reliable, always waiting for them with open arms back at altitude. They are 8-0 at home this season after a 132-120 rout of the Spurs in Wembanyama's first visit to the Front Range. The highly touted rookie registered 22 points, 11 rebounds, 4 blocks, and 6 steals, but Nikola Jokic managed to win the opening tip against all 7 feet and 4 inches of Wembanyama, a.k.a. Wemby, foreshadowing the next 2 hours. Jokic piled up an efficient 39 points, 11 rebounds, and 9 assists to hand San Antonio its 12th consecutive loss. The Nuggets' only 3 wins in the last 8 games have come against teams with losing streaks of 5 or more games. But never mind the opponent, they needed this one coming off a 1-4 road trip that ended with group stage elimination from the in-season tournament. Especially with 3 more road games waiting in the next 6 days, starting Monday at the Clippers in a back-to-back. "Last year we only had 19 road wins, and that was a point of emphasis going into this year," Nuggets coach Michael Malone said. We have to find a way to be more competitive on the road, and it starts with our defense. The Nuggets, 11-6, outscored the Spurs 64-46 in the paint in a return to form. They got bounce-back performances from Michael Porter Jr. and Reggie Jackson. A 20-point lead opened up in the second quarter, but it was 12 by halftime and 7 when Malone called a timeout 2 minutes into the third. Denver responded with a 14-2 run to stretch the lead back to 19 at the halfway point of the quarter. After Friday's loss in Houston wrapped up the dismal road trip, Malone told his players he planned to make changes to the rotation because he was seeing too many empty minutes off the bench. A right heel strain caused Aaron Gordon to miss Sunday's game and might have also interrupted Malone's bow, but his depth chart at the four was noteworthy nonetheless. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.